Listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio AM 820 brings you Foundations in Faith. Join Monsignor Frank Lane as he offers insights into the readings heard at Mass. And now, Foundations in Faith with Monsignor Frank Lane.
This is Father Frank Lane, and we're continuing our program, Foundations in Faith. We've been following along with the Gospel of St. Luke, and today we're going to look at Luke 12, verses 13 to 21. This is a really kind of, well, all the gospel stories are really very interesting, but this one raises an enormous number of contemporary questions. It follows in Luke's gospel upon a discussion of the relationship between Christ and ourselves and Christ and other people. And it's where we find some very radical statements that basically do tend to cause consternation. For instance, in Matthew's gospel, who has preserved the real Semitic rigor of Jesus' words, says, if anyone would come after me and not hate his father, or then says, whoever loves his father or mother more than me, these kinds of things, this idea, Jesus is trying to impress upon people with this particular gospel, in an introduction to this particular gospel, the real tremendous importance of choosing him above the cultural and personal attachments of our lives. We go back to the story of Martha and Mary, and we saw there that while this is not a criticism of Martha at all, it's kind of a friendly jesting with her, a friendly chiding her, but the whole idea being, certainly we have the necessary things to do in our lives, but there is also time in the midst of those to do that, to give the Lord the time that we owe the Lord. Well, in this gospel, after he has finished kind of this discussion about the relationship in family and him and so forth, it says, a man in the crowd said to Jesus, Master, tell my brother to give me a share in our inheritance. And Jesus says to him, my friend, who appointed you me your judge or the arbiter of your claims? And then he said to them, watch and be on your guard against avarice of any kind. For a man's life is not made secure by what he owns, even when he has more than he needs. So, this then is kind of taking, it's not really mean. It's not kind of even very harsh. It's saying, you know, we have been talking about this kind of dependency, this kind of real need of a dependency on God. And you have introduced into it now a very normal question. Jesus presents himself as a teacher of truth, as an arbiter of justice, and so forth. And this man obviously feels that there is a lack of justice going on in his life. And so he says to Jesus, tell my brother to give me a share in our inheritance. The background, no one knows what the background is. Apparently, if he's asking this, the brother, who is what we would probably call the executor of the estate, is not sharing as he should the goods of the parents with his own brother. And so does it imply, in a sense, in some way, shape, or form, an injustice? It does imply an injustice. Doesn't mean that there is one. It simply implies that there might certainly be one. So Jesus says to him, though, you know, it's interesting that you bring me this question, but I'm not the arbiter of your claims, and I'm not the judge of the civil laws that govern your claims. That is, a matter of fact, the only thing I would say to you, if this is so important to you that you bring it out to me, that whatever you do, be careful that it is not motivated by avarice, that it is not motivated by greed, and that you do not see the security of your life as a human person based on your acquisition of wealth, your acquisition of your inherited goods. So Jesus uses the occasion then to become kind of the teacher of the man, to say to him, be careful. He's not saying you have no right to go after your part of the inheritance. You have no right to desire it. He doesn't say any of those kinds of things. What he says is, be careful why you're doing it. And be careful how you do it, because if you're doing it because you want more wealth, or you want more, or because you're going to feel secure, more secure if you get what you think is coming to you, be careful of that, Jesus says, because it can corrupt you and it can misinterpret the meaning of life for you. And then he goes on after this and he tells them a story. There was once a rich man who, having had a good harvest from his land, thought to himself, "What am I to do? I have not enough room to store my crops." Then he said, "This is what I will do. I will pull down my barns and build bigger ones and store all my grain and my goods in them. And I will say to my soul, you have plenty of good things laid by for many years to come. Take things easy, eat, drink, have a good time." But God said to him, "Fool. This very night the demand will be made for your soul. And this hoard of yours, whose will it be then?" And so it is when a man stores up treasure for himself in place of making himself rich in the sight of God. This is something we have to reflect upon, something that we have to pray about. Many people will go to these kinds of passages within the gospel and try to extract from them some kind of predetermined financial economic structure of a society, which in some way, shape, or form reflects the gospel and therefore becomes an absolute. Now, who knows what that? There's all sorts of different economic systems. You know, there's the barter system, there was the sharing system, there's socialism, there's radical capitalism, there's all those kinds of things. And the question is, now, which one of them is the official Christian economic system? And the answer is none. There is no official Christian economic system. That economics develop in the world in which we live in response to all sorts of stimuli, all sorts of needs, all sorts of ways of sustaining a society, a civilization. If we were to say, fine, we're going to go back into the ways of the Middle Ages, and the only value we're going to recognize as Christians is land, and everything else is artificial, destructive, and deceitful, and seductive. If we do that, we're silly. There's too many people for the only wealth there be to be the possession of land. It can't be done as a viable way to run a huge society. So society strives to find its own ways. And whatever those ways are, if they lend themselves to following the basic commandments of the Christian life, if they lend themselves to offering some kind of assistance and help to people who cannot survive and cannot function within a society. I remember many, many years ago, back in the middle 60s, actually, when the Iron Curtain was still up, and especially and Czechoslovakia was one of the strongest and most Stalinist of the countries of the East Bloc at that time, I remember going back there and one summer working there on a collective farm. It was quite an exercise in discretion and something that when you're 22 years old you might want to do, but I'm not sure that it would make much sense if you were much older than that. So, but anyways, there was interesting discussions, and I remember one evening sitting around with some of the local villagers, because in Europe mostly the farmers don't farm like they do in the States. In most places, farmers live in villages and go out to their fields, whereas through our whole Homestead Act, our whole way of settling and everything, we lived on the land that we farmed. And that was common in our country. In Europe, that was less common. Not that it doesn't happen, it was less common. And that usually they gathered in villages and then went out to their lands. So in the village, sitting around one evening, I remember them peppering with questions. What if you needed false teeth? How much would it cost you? What if you needed glasses? How much would it cost you? How much does dental work cost? How much does all this cost? And so, obviously, I didn't have all that, but I had a sense of some of it was. I had grandparents that were dealing with those kinds of things, also knew something about, I had a sister that wore glasses, so I knew what that was all about. And so I was telling him, and I remember then as we talked, and here they are in the communist bloc, and they were aware of the fact that they had no freedom, and they were aware of the fact of the oppression. They were aware of all that. But on the other hand, talking about living in this society terrified them. They thought, well, we could never do that. We couldn't survive. How would we do that? Well, it wasn't their experience. Of course, if they were here, they would have figured out to do it. But not everybody can figure out how to live in every kind of society. And those who are unable to function in any given society are those for whom any political and economic system should be attentive and caring. It's not for those who will not, but those who struggle and cannot. That's a whole different issue. And there are those who cannot survive in the socialist system, and there are those who cannot survive in even a modified and mitigated capitalist system such as we have. So in every society, no matter what it is, there are those who really just can't respond. The society has a responsibility to them because they're human people and because they're children of God, and because if they are not capable of functioning the way that the rest of the society functions, then they should be looked after in some way, shape, or form. And in the most cases, certainly in modern times, at least, we have been sensitive to that. We have done that. We have overdone it in some cases and basically deprived the people of really the kind of need that they have to move beyond a dependency stage. All of those are huge social, economic, and cultural questions. None of those are addressed in the gospel today. What is addressed in the gospel today is our personal inner self, our inner value system, our understanding on ourselves, the way in which we identify ourselves, the way in which we understand ourselves, our goals in life, and our value system. That's what the gospel engages in today. And so when he says, watch and be on your guard against avarice of any kind, he's not saying you have no right to go after your inheritance. He's not saying that. He's just saying, I'm not the one that's to do that for you. And then he says, for a man's life is not made secure by what he owns, even when he has more than he needs. And I think this goes back to a discussion we had also at one time about the whole nature of that economics played in the whole Reformation system. And we talked about Max Weber's analysis of that, how controversial it is, and yet how much insight there nevertheless is in his arguments, and the idea of him making the distinction between capitalism as oriented toward consumption and capitalism oriented toward acquisition. What he argues, of course, is that the Protestant Reformation altered the capitalism that was inherent in Europe. And in so doing, in placing and making it away from consuming things into acquiring things. And then he goes on to argue that the acquisition was used not in accordance really with the theology of Calvin at all, but with a cultural sense of Calvinism, that that certainly wealth was a sign of divine election, divine privilege, divine blessing. We still tend to do that, say, oh, how blessed this person is, you know, they're a multimillionaire. Well, you know, maybe they are blessed and maybe they aren't, but it doesn't have anything to do with their wealth. That has to do with how they function within the society as it exists that we have in some way created, for with all of its strengths and with all of its deficits. So then when Jesus goes on to tell the parable, he goes back then not to an economic structure, but he goes back to the personal, to that which is inside of a human person. What are your values? What are your values? There is a conflict all the time in the contemporary church, in an American society, about values. What, for instance, is the most important thing in a person's life? What is it? Previous to this gospel, in preparation for this gospel, Jesus says it had better be God. because only when God is the central place in your life are you able to orient the rest of your life in a healthy, a good, a spiritual, a deeply human and profound sort of way. That when we attach ourselves to those things which are extraneous to ourselves and rely on those things for the meaning of our lives, then we have distorted the inner person. We have reoriented the created nature of the human person, and we have dangerously attached them to to external phenomenon. Today, what's happening is a lot of it is wealth, certainly. A lot of it is we hear the stories, the novels, the movies, and so forth about the corruption at the top of the power ladders and all of this kind of thing. But it's also today what's happening is the great attachments that is not so ferociously the economic attachments as the ideological attachments. When someone places a particular political party above and beyond their commitment to Jesus Christ and their faith life, when they try to distort their faith life, as many prominent politicians tend to do, what they're doing is they're trying to justify in this case and in this gospel story their barns filled with goods. They're trying to justify themselves on the basis of something other than the divine, something other than the origin of where they have come from, the origin of who God has identified them to be. They're trying to identify themselves and justify their existence by their commitment to ideology. That's dangerous for us, because what it is implicitly is a denial of the primacy of God in our lives. It is a denial of our total dependency on the grace of God in our lives. It takes away our self-understanding, and it makes us in some way not see ourselves essentially as primarily accountable to God in our lives, but accountable to exterior phenomena in our lives, whether that is barns filled with grain, whether that is multi-millions of dollars in the bank, whatever that is. If that's what defines us as a person, then we are in trouble. If our ideology defines us as a person, if our political orientation defines us as a person, then we have violated the spirit of this gospel and we have placed ourselves in jeopardy. I think you can find, and of course, I suppose it's easy to pick on these people because they're constantly in the public eye and in the public media and so forth. But those who try to carry the name Catholic or Christian into the public arena, and yet are totally committed to ideology that is antithetical to the Christian life, what we usually see then is an incredible form of arrogance and abuse of power that becomes part of their lives, because they feel justified in somehow or other to having a moral superiority over those who are faithful disciples of the Lord, for they have given themselves over to the power of this world. It's not a mute question, and we see it not only within our society all the time, but it became a great issue ever in the last 40 or 50 years in Latin America, in what we refer to as liberation theology. It was very interesting that the whole notion, certainly, that we look at the Beatitudes, we understand, and I think that we've talked about financial or economic structures besides, we have an obligation to the poor, we have an obligation to assist those who through no fault of their own cannot compete or participate in the complicated, sophisticated modern structures of life. What happened was in Latin America, of course, there was a powerful, rich power structure and a continent of many peasants, something that the Jesuits and their reductions in the 16th century attempted to address. St. Junipero Serra along the coast of California tried to do that as well. And so finally, in the more socially conscious ages of the mid-20th century, there developed a theological structure by many Latin American theoreticians about called liberation theology. There's a wonderful response on the part of the church to that in a decree from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith by Cardinal Ratzinger. But basically, something happened. The desire to serve the poor and to alleviate their suffering turned into an economic and a political movement that itself sought power. And when they got that power, they abused it. Look at Fidel Castro in Cuba. Look at Maduro in Venezuela. That's supposed to help the poor. That is basically enslave them to a failing economic system and tyranny. And all of it based on the same kind of foundational work that has gone on in much of the program of liberation theology in Latin America, which has tended many. I know Leonardo Boff, for instance, who was one of the great liberation theologians, studied at the University of Munich in the 60s, and was heavily influenced by the German kind of acceptance of Marxist political and economic philosophy. That became very much a part of liberation theology, and that was the condemnation of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, is that instead of being interested in the eternal salvation of the poor and to help them, to be free them, to seek that more in their lives, they came to have kind of a material end, a material goal to the work of the church. And the work of the church then became, in the minds of many of the liberation theologians, not all, but many of the liberation theologians, kind of violent revolution and seizing means of power and money and all of this kind of stuff. How that kind of gets interpreted into the Christian ethos, I really don't know, because what we hear Jesus saying is, "My friend, who appointed me your judge or the arbiter of your claims?" And then all he says is, "Do not be greedy." So this attempt to pull the gospel of the Lord and the Lord's attention to the poor and the Lord's demand that we be attentive to the poor into some kind of a Christian ideology that advocates in the end, such as Hugo Chavez did and such as Morales in Bolivia and so forth, all of these people, revolution then they call Christian. And nowhere does Jesus say that. Nowhere does Jesus advocate that. If Jesus were to agree with them, he would have led a revolution against the Roman occupation of Israel, of Palestine. He never did that. He ignored the Roman officials, except insofar as they came to him in petition. When the centurion came to him and wanted him to heal his son, or the public official came and wanted him to heal his daughter and so forth. That was his engagement with the Roman Empire, nothing else. This whole idea to somehow or other say that there is a certain Christian justification for violence or for revolution or for exploitation, you won't find it in the Gospels. You can extend it out and you can say, well, you know, there are times when, you know, Christians have risen up for the rights of their people. And so, yeah, that's probably true. But to say somehow that the salvation of the human person depends upon their material well-being, and when we ignore the ultimate goal and the ultimate purpose of the human person, when we ignore that, then our material solutions are not extracted or derived from the gospel. We can say all sorts of political things can go on. We can say all sorts of things can happen. What do we make, for instance, of the American Revolution? Was that justified or was it not justified? Was it a Christian movement or wasn't it a Christian movement? It doesn't seem to have been. So what was it? We have to ask these kinds of questions, but at the core is the very question that Jesus puts at the heart of it. Do not be guilty of avarice, and do not think that material realities, whether that's wealth or power or ideology, is somehow or other going to set you up in a way God looks and says, "You fool. This very night the demand will be made for your soul. And this hoard of yours, whose will it be then?" And so it is with the man who stores up treasure for himself in place of making himself rich in the sight of God. Treasure and wealth can have many names, many forms in the societies in which we live. We can talk about wealth. We can talk about power. We can talk about revolution. We can talk about anger. We can talk about justification for hatred because of somehow or other the frustration of our sense of the well-being of ourselves as human persons. Jesus here does not accept any of that. He accepts what he has said before, that to make yourself rich only makes sense if you are making yourself rich in the sight of God. And this does not mean that poor people can't do that. It doesn't mean that rich people can't do that. It doesn't mean that successful people can't do that. It doesn't mean that unsuccessful people can't do that. Every human person has the capacity to allow their soul to be enriched by the presence of God, in the grace of God, in the Word of God, in such a way that they have a great sense of themselves, a great strength of character, and a great and a generous heart. And that can exist among people in any place, in any time, in any situation. So this morning, then, as we hear this word proclaim, let's expand the idea of wealth into also power, revolution, ideology, social structure, governments, economic systems, all of those things, and hear the word of the Lord who says to us, "My friend, who appointed me your judge or the arbiter of your claims?" Then he said to him, "Watch and be on your guard against avarice of any kind. For a man's life is not made secure by what he owns, even when he has more than he needs." Thus says the Lord to us, and each of us should take that deep within our own soul, in our own heart, deep into our prayer, asking God to help us to acknowledge him as the most important reality of our life and as the source of the deepest values of our lives.
Foundations in Faith is a production of listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820. Archives of Foundations in Faith are available at stgabrielradio.com.